Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Unless you've been purposefully offline, you have no doubt been inundated by news, videos, pictures, and sounds from the deadly terror of Sunday night's mass shooting in Las Vegas. Later this hour, we'll air a special interview about how to talk to the kids in your lives about violence in the news. But our conversation for the main part of the show sits in sort of uneasy proximity to last night's event. We're going to talk about hate, extremism, violence, and about whether the feeling many people have is accurate about an increase in extremist ideology. We don't know enough about what happened in Las Vegas or about the alleged shooter, a 64-year-old white Nevada resident named Stephen Paddock, to slot this directly into any neat box. But the atmosphere of violence and hate that existed before last night still persists, and so we're going to feel the presence of Las Vegas hovering near the conversation we have today. Mark Potok is our guest. He's one of the country's top experts on white supremacy, hate groups, and right-wing extremism. He's a former senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and he grew up in Plainfield, Vermont. He's in town to give a talk at UVM this evening about anti-Semitism and right-wing extremism. Mark, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So you've spent your career looking at these issues. Is there a perhaps overly simplistic but easy way to characterize the state of things in America today?
Well, the state of things in America today, very similar to the state of things in Europe today, is that I think we're unquestionably seeing a rise in white nationalism generally, more specifically anti-Semitism and all kinds of other hatreds of Muslims, of LGBT people, and so on, and that this does not come out of the clear blue sky. Although there are certainly many people in the world that I cover who are mentally ill and so on, the reality is that they are reflecting or reacting to something very real that's happening in the world. The country, as well as much of Europe, is changing and changing very dramatically over the course of the last 20 years and I'm afraid, for the next 20 years or so. What I mean when I say that is we are living in a world, in a country, where, among other things, the demographics are changing radically. This is a country that has been 90% white since essentially the very beginning of the colonial era. It is now about 62% white, and by 2044, according to the Census Bureau, whites will, for the first time in all these many years, lose their majority. So there's a huge demographic change happening. At the same time, there are big shifts in the culture. I think the most obvious example of that being same-sex marriage, right? I mean, you think about same-sex marriage 15 years ago, it seemed unimaginable, kind of on a par with having a black president. And here we are.
But don't those things seem like they're in opposition? We have now same-sex marriage throughout the country. We have had a black president, and yet you see right-wing extremism, you see racism, you see hatred on the rise.
And it's a backlash, right? I mean, in fact, anti-black racism among whites rose and rose pretty significantly during the 8 years under Obama, not what anybody really expected. It seems counterintuitive until you think about it. But, for the people, the tens of millions of white Americans who feel like this isn't the country they grew up in, that somehow the ground is being cut out from underneath their feet, they look up and they see a black man in the White Office. They look up and they see, two men walking down the street hand in hand, that kind of thing. And there's this huge, visceral reaction. And it's happened before in our history. Let me say, by the way, the third sort of factor, and this is all really related to globalization, in effect, the world becoming more and more knit together, is the idea that, huge sectors of our economies are being hurt and hurt badly. So, talk to a former steel worker, a former auto worker, a former textile worker, and you begin to understand the rage out there. When I talk about Europe, you think a little bit about the Brexit vote last fall. I think the people who voted for Brexit in the United Kingdom were very much the analog of the people who voted for Trump here. Of course, this is a gross generalization, but we are talking about working class, lower middle class whites who live, you know, here by and large in the kind of the old Rust Belt in England. It's the North Counties, which are very analogous, these sort of deindustrializing areas.
And Wales.
Yeah, right. All of this is happening. And, you know, to me, it's very similar to what we saw happen between really the turn of the 20th century and the 1920s, when America was changing also in these hugely dramatic ways, right? A country that was primarily rural was becoming primarily industrial. Women were coming out of the home and going into the workplace. You know, farm communities, like in Vermont today, I mean, where people have real, you know, relationships with people all around them, were disintegrating in those relationships. So people were unmoored, were disappearing. And many other things were happening, too. You know, the Scopes trial, 1924, religion's under attack, the rise of rationalism. You know, sex is sort of out there in a way that it hasn't been before. You know, many people don't know this, I think, but, you know, what we think of as the Jazz Age and, you know, all this hot action in the cities. Well, at the very same time in the early 20s, there was a huge crash in farm prices right across the country. So it was the same kind of, you know, this isn't the country I grew up in. Who are all these new people? What are women doing in my marketplace? Why am I, you know, seeing flappers running around, you know, wearing hardly anything and all of that? So I think we're going through a very similar time. And, you know, in this case, we're seeing it right across the Western world.
So in the 1920s, Mark, when you saw this massive change happening across the country, what were some of the ways that extremism reared up that you see as a sort of analog to today?
Well, the 1920s was the time, peaking in 1925, of the largest Klan in history, by far. Right, about 4 million members of the Klan, at a time when the population of the country was, you know, significantly less than half of what it is today. So that's pretty dramatic. And the Klan was hardly limited to the South. In fact, in many ways, it was stronger in the North. You know, it was primarily an anti-Catholic Klan at that time, although it was certainly anti-Jewish and anti-black as well. So, you know, we saw that the Klan, and unlike the Klan today, of course, genuinely powerful. The Klan was in large part responsible, or partly responsible, for the passage of the 1925 Immigration Act. And that is the act that put into place for 40 years a genuinely racist quota system. You know, essentially it was based on the idea that no more than 2% of our immigrants each year will come from the population as it now is in 1925. And what that meant in actual reality was Northern and Western Europeans, you know, Central Europe, Germanic peoples, English peoples, and so on. You know, back then, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the Greeks, the Italians were all considered a little dirty, a little non-white. Catholicism was an odd, you know, weird religion. These people probably had secret alliances to the Pope, a sort of dual loyalty charge, and so on. So, you know, to make a long story short, extremists were very much on the rise then, very powerful, you know, very much unlike today. You saw Klansmen who were governors of states who ran entire states, like the state of Indiana, which was absolutely under the thumb of the Klan. And there were a whole lot of other proto-fascist groups running around at the very same time, the late 20s and the 30s, the William Pelley Silver Shirts, and so on and so on. Charles Coughlin, you know, we're talking on the radio, the infamous radio priest, you know, who spoke to something like 8 million Americans every day on CBS radio and gave these daily monologues, these really rants, diatribes about the evils of the Jews and what Jews were doing to the country and so on. Of course, this is also the period from 1920 to 1927 that Henry Ford is publishing in his newspaper, the Dearborn Independent, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, encapsulated in this long series called The International Jew. So a lot was happening. I mean, in the end, the United States turned away from authoritarianism and fascism as we approached the war, but it was not for want of trying, as it were. I mean, we came close.
So you say the KKK, for example, not as powerful today, certainly. But do you draw a parallel to right-wing extremism? We see things like, and this is a little bit of a controversial term still, but the alt-right, and I know you've been looking at the alt-right. You're going to be talking about the alt-right and anti-Semitism tonight at UVM. But there are members of that particular ideology who have held very powerful positions, including in our White House. Do you see that comparison?
Well, until now, until very recently, no. I mean, it is very rare, though some people will allege otherwise, that we find a police officer anywhere in Mississippi or Vermont who is secretly a member of the Klan. You know, you won't find a politician at the national level who's a member of the Klan or of a similar group. And when that kind of thing comes out, at least until a couple of years ago, that person is finished. They're washed up. So, no, it's different in that sense. I mean, there was real, genuine political power attached to the Klan, and they were hardly viewed as extremists back then. They were, you know, kind of a mainstream fraternal organization. But, you know, what we didn't mention at the very beginning was, you know, in addition to the factors I kind of talked about, you know, fostering the rise of right-wing extremism across the West is, of course, Donald Trump and all that he has wrought. And, you know, I think to me it's absolutely undeniable that Trump has normalized this kind of hatred and moved it right to the mainstream. I mean, you know.
When you say it's undeniable, spell that out, how
well,
you say it's
for
undeniable.
Instance, well, first of all, you think of what Trump did during the campaign, right? His campaign, the very first speech begins with an attack on all Mexican immigrants as rapists and so on. You know, then we move
Although
into the Muslims.
He says there are probably a few.
There may be. He assumes there are one or, you know, some good ones out there too. You know, and it goes on from there, right? I mean, Muslims are so suspect that we need to set up databases. We need to ban them from this country. We need to surveil mosques, you know, and it moves through each group. And of course, women get it too from Trump in a particularly nasty way. But, you know, that also happens to almost all other minorities. And, you know, the fact, you know, much has been said, of course, about the fact that David Duke and various Klan and neo-Nazi leaders think Trump is, as they call him, our glorious leader and just a really fab guy. You know, and perhaps we can't directly blame Trump for that. But, you know, the extent to which Trump has sort of normalized and helped bring these people in into the center of our political life or close to it, I think is reflected a lot in the wave of criminal and somewhat less than criminal violence and hatreds really unleashed in the immediate aftermath of Trump's election. So starting, you know, literally hours after Trump was declared the winner of the election in November, we saw about an 8-week long, just, you know, huge upsurge in all kinds of incidents, right?
And these and an upsurge that is actually measured in statistics?
Yes. Well, the SPLC, where I worked at the time, the Southern Poverty Law Center, counted, I remember, I think it was 1,094 incidents or something like that in the first 37 days, if I remember. You know, not all of these amounted to crimes in the sense a lot of it was bullying in schools and so on. But so, you know, we don't really have a genuinely comparable data set to say, you know, it's up 32.3% or something like that. But, you know, from my point of view as an anecdotal matter, there was just no question about it. It was obvious and it was right across the country. And one of the remarkable things was that it wasn't just anti-Muslim or anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic or anti-gay or anti-woman. It was all of those things and more. So every kind of conceivable sort of hatred was unleashed, you know, kind of a Pandora's box. And, you know, to again make the case that this is something sort of historical happening, the very same thing happened in the immediate aftermath of the Brexit vote in the United Kingdom. There were a couple of months of really remarkable upsurges in hate crimes. And in that case, they had real data that was comparable and they could really say, you know, there's no question it's up 80% or whatever it was.
Let's engage some of our callers in this conversation. Robert is on the line with us from Barton. Hi, Robert. Go right ahead.
Thank you very much. I agree with much of what your guest is saying. But I have one disagreement. I think that racism, more than any other force, elected Donald Trump. And I urge you to read Ta-Nehisi Coates' article in the Atlantic magazine, because he points out dramatically how this happened, that Donald Trump captured every white demographic group in the country, including very wealthy white people. I am 79 years old. And I've had a good life, and I attribute most of my good luck to the fact that I have white privilege. I have had the advantage of white privilege my whole life, and every other white person would have to admit to the same thing. I just feel that the biggest problem in the country is not economic, it's racial. and millions of Americans are racist. We have to face that and work forward from there. Thank you.
Robert, well, I appreciate your call. Mark, you wanted to jump
in? Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with that. I mean, I'm not sure I would assign it. This is the absolute number one, but
why
clearly.
Not? Just because there's well, because so many number ones.
It's such a mix, right? I mean, racism gets mixed in with how I feel like I'm doing in the world, you know, how I feel, you know, I lost my job and I see the black guy next door didn't lose his, and I read about affirmative action in the paper and it makes me angry and so on. But, I mean, really, the polling shows very, very clearly that really the thing that people talk about in these polls is quote unquote cultural identity. And that's race, right? It's your whiteness that is somehow under attack. Do you feel like this is, you know, the same country your parents grew up in, those kinds of things? And when you dig down the smallest bit, you are really talking about race. So I do think that's true, but I think it's a mistake to sort of, you know, assign a single factor to something that's happening, which is obviously very broad-based. You know, and this sort of gets us to the question of, is every person who voted for Donald Trump a Klansman in disguise? And I think that's clearly not true. I'm not defending Trump voters. But I used to cover labor as a reporter 30, 40 years ago and was one of the last labor reporters in the country, actually. You know, and many of those people who I very much admired voted for Trump. Right. And these were people who were by and large, I was covering the Steelworkers Union in the Chicago area mainly. You know, these were people who had been in a very left wing union for many years, very much on the left of the labor movement. And some of them, certainly not all of them, but some of them voted for Trump as well. So, you know, that got me to thinking about the idea that, you know, yes, it's race, but there are a lot of other things entangled with race.
We asked people on Reddit, has Vermont become more hateful? And we got some really interesting responses from Redditors, and I'll read a few of them here. CFI Care says, I think it's more a matter of being open about the things that people have thought for a long time or they ignored and just now are opening their eyes to the world's and the state's troubles. The rural versus urban divide is another issue. I don't think it's blind hate, though. Most people have their reasons or justifications, at least from their point of view. Detector Sarcasm, another editor, says, I don't know if I'd say more hateful, maybe more open about hatefulness people would have kept quiet about before. The most noticeable shift is in extreme anger, even against the local media at this point. It used to be, even if people railed against national media, they at least acknowledged most local writers and journalists were well-intentioned and interested in presenting an impartial view. Now I'd say most people flip out at a story that doesn't conform to their worldview. And Starkiller 2013 says, I've noticed people feeling it's okay to, quote, speak their minds about issues and peoples more. But it's mainly from the redneck types or people who close their minds off to any other options. I tend to just try to ignore the comments they make. Taking a walk out in nature tends to remind me of what's really important. More on this conversation as we continue. We're talking with Mark Potok and hearing from some of you about what you think about extremism, violent ideology in the news today in our country. Obviously, our minds are on the people injured and killed in Las Vegas and their loved ones. And so many questions remain unanswered. We don't know enough yet where we can put this devastating event in terms of motive or ideology. So I want to be clear that we're not making a comparison or a connection to specific groups or identities. But the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history certainly exists in the context of the national conversation about extremism and about violence. Rana Parvis, a Redditor who answered our question about has Vermont become more hateful? Are you seeing more hate in Vermont? Writes, first time in 10 years living here that my neighbor felt comfortable enough to put up a Confederate flag on his house, and it's still up. A friend who just moved to Vermont, a naturalized American who was a refugee from the Congo, has already been called an N-word at work. He's been here since July. Would that have happened before? I don't know, but the other coworkers there were pretty shocked. And Indefinable Mustache says, I don't necessarily see more hate, but I did see a bit more of an intolerant attitude pop up over the past year. I'm specifically referring to the refugees that were going to be resettled in Rutland. Seems like there was a decent opposition to that, but I did also see many people from Rutland ready to welcome them with open arms. And let's take a call from Elena in Burlington. Hi, Elena. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me on. So, I guess I'll open a little bit about myself. I happen to be a black transgender woman. I grew up in Essex Junction. I live in Burlington. I've been in Vermont for about 25 years. I definitely agree with a lot of those Redditors that I don't think that there's any more hatred, racism, xenophobia, bigotry. In recent times, it's just that with the current national administration, I think what a lot of people predicted is correct, is that what is actually on the rise is just a sort of emboldened state for people who hold racist views. In that same way, though, I think that the one thing that gets overlooked a lot of the time is just the fact that, you know, it's really not a matter of being a racist, or I think that's something that a lot of Vermonters kind of like fall victim to, is that it's not kind of this checkbox where you are either racist or not racist. The overall issue is that white supremacy is a reality. We live in an extremely, extremely white state in a country that was built on the backs of slaves, with a government that has never officially apologized for that atrocity. And, you know, we're all kind of complicit, no matter which way you slice it, in white supremacist behaviors. And I think the sooner we all kind of start checking our own behaviors and really kind of becoming involved in making it an active process of sort of not making room for these type of ideologies to, you know, seed and grow and bear fruit in the form of violence and hate, the sooner we can actually move on from a lot of this country's legacy of violence.
Elena, I appreciate your perspective and for you sharing it and sharing a little bit about your personal story. Thank you. Let's hear from Chuck in Saratoga Springs, New York. Hi, Chuck. You're on the air.
Thank you. My comment was about the recent discussion you just had and the reference to the current administration normalizing hate. My feeling is, I agree with that. My feeling is, however, that the discussion should also be more specific with respect to how the current administration has enabled some hate groups and, in fact, has empowered them in some ways with a degree of respect and acknowledged essentially their existence.
Yeah, Chuck, thanks for the call. Mark Potok, what do you think? Is there more than a normalization? Is there either an implicit endorsement coming from Washington or an enabling?
Yeah, I mean, there's an enabling for sure. I mean, let's remember that Trump, speaking just about anti-black racism for a moment, you know, I think people may not remember so well that, you know, Trump during his rallies in places like Mobile, Alabama, where I am, literally encouraged people at his rallies to physically attack black protesters, right? Again and again. This happened all over the country on several occasions, including the infamous televised sucker punch of a Black Lives Matter protester being let out of a rally. Trump offered to pay the legal costs of these people, right? And then, you know, then he goes on and then he'll talk about my Negroes and that sort of thing from time to time. I mean, it really is quite amazing. So, yes, it's a little more than simply mainstreaming or normalizing. I mean, it's a permission giving. You know, one thing that I saw very clearly in the years at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and people may not always see this as clearly, you know, as I think I do, but is that what leaders say, what people in the public square say, really matters in a way that is hard to understand, especially in a place like Vermont that seems, you know, kind of very far away from the federal government in many ways. But just to give you an example, immediately after 9/11, there was about a 1,600 or 1,700 jump in anti-Muslim hate crimes. Well, you know, hardly surprising, right? 3,000 Americans had just been murdered in one of the most spectacular attacks in history. What was surprising was that in 2002, a mere 3.5 months later, we saw anti-Muslim hate crimes go down by 67%, a full two-thirds.
And from the original number or
from the raised number? But I mean, look, I mean, I can only suppose. But to me, that's remarkable. You know, 3.5 months after this incredible slaughter, you know, of radical Islamists, whatever you want to call it, we saw this very dramatic drop. And I think that that was in large part, believe it or not, due to what President George W. Bush said at the time. You know, whatever else one might think of the man, he did again and again go out there in public and say, Muslims are not our enemy. Arabs are not our enemy. Our enemy is this very specific group. It's called Al-Qaeda. You know, he stood in the National Cathedral and all these religious settings, sort of shoulder to shoulder with imams and so on. And it really meant something. You know, to give a reverse example, in 2010, after years and years of declining anti-Muslim hate crime since 2002, we saw a 50% jump. And when you think back to 2010, there were no major jihadist attacks. There were no, you know, those kinds of outrageous slaughters in Nice and Paris and Brussels and so on. In fact, the only things that really happened relative to that were a woman named Pamela Geller ginned up in New York City, a huge, you know, brouhaha around what she called the Victory Mosque, the Ground Zero Mosque, which was neither a mosque nor a Ground Zero. But, you know, the idea that the Muslims were coming to build, you know, a mosque over the graves of our, you know, fellow murdered Americans and so on. And this was in New York City, right, the biggest media market in the world. So it went all over the country. We started to see the same kinds of mosque controversies popping up in places like Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And the other thing that happened in 2010 was another, you know, anti-Muslim ideologue, David Yaroshalmi, wrote a whole huge report alleging, in effect, that Sharia law was being imposed on American criminal courts. And he drew up this American Laws for American Courts legislation, which now I think about 8 states have actually passed. You know, so there was all of this poison in the air, and in my opinion, that it pretty much solely accounts for the jump. So back to the basic idea, you know, it really does matter what leaders say. Let me just say briefly about Vermont. Sure, I think probably to some small measure, hate is on the rise here, or at least it's more visible. But, you know, I have to say, you know, having lived in Alabama for the last 20 years and other parts of the country, that, you know, Vermont is a relatively calm place. I think people should understand that. And, you know, I realize there have been these incidents, but they're really quite minor. You know, they're a symptom of a larger problem. But Vermont, I would say, is doing pretty well. I mean, if you look at the SPLC map right now, there's one tiny little hate group listed in Burlington, period. Right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question there is, you know, so then we're talking about groups that have already risen to the level where the SPLC is looking
new group.
At them.
That is one of the groups that rose on the back of Donald Trump. That's Andrew Anglin's Daily Stormer, which has become, you know, the premier neo-Nazi site on the web.
And isn't based in Vermont, right? But there
no,
are there's, branches.
No, he set up little clubs around the country, and this is one of the clubs. And, you know, it's arguable how much they really meet or how real and substantial they really are. It's an amazing website, on the other hand. And, you know, that guy is the guy who dubbed Donald Trump our glorious leader. And let me just say, I mean, the Daily Stormer is named after Der Stürmer, which was an unbelievably anti-Semitic and sort of pornographically anti-Semitic newspaper run by Julius Streicher in the early 1930s in Germany. And you know, as a sort of parenthetical ending to that, you know, Streicher was hung in Nuremberg for his crimes.
So, Mark, you've taken us back to history again, and maybe history can offer us a sense of where you think things may be going. Are things going to get worse before they get better? Are we, you know, what's
yes,
your sense?
I think things are going to get worse before they get better. You know, I think the demographic transformation in this country is really important. And, you know,
because the country will be a majority non-white by what, 2044 is what people
2044,
think?
Which is around the corner, right? It's less than 25 years away. So I think what we're looking at is really a huge change, but we've come through other changes before, right? I mean, women are not treated like they were in the 1920s anymore. I mean, arguably, things could be better. But there are, you know, I think to say it's all the same and it's just always there and this is the same as the 20s and it's the same as the 1860s is really false. So all that to say that, you know, the transformation we're undergoing is essentially unprecedented in history. You know, what country has gone through a change where it has been really dominated by one social group and then it has moved into, you know, what arguably could be described as a real democracy, a democracy in which no one group is ruling. So, you know, my hope is that, you know, yes, we're going to go through these struggles over the next 20 years. But, you know, the hope is that we come out at the end of the tunnel and, you know, and kind of blossom as a genuinely multicultural democracy. in which people feel less oppressed.
Well, that's an optimistic way to look at it.
Yes,
at any rate. Mark Potok is a former senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center. He'll be delivering a lecture entitled Anti-Semitism and the Alt-Right Movement in the U.S. at the University of Vermont Davis Center tonight at 7 p.m. Mark, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.